today, looking back more than 100 years to a pandemic that changed the world.
I'm puzzled that novelists don't make more of pandemics. They seem to use them as metaphors rather than actually writing about what happens in them realistically. But I think they bring out the very best and the very worst in human nature. So, you know, we've seen the stockpiling behaviour lately, but we've also seen people pulling together, and you saw the same in 1918.
Laura Spinney is a science writer and a journalist who is watching the unfolding coronavirus pandemic with a slightly different perspective from the rest of us. That's because she's written a book about one of the worst virus outbreaks of modern times, the Spanish flu, which first emerged in 1918 and is believed to have killed up to 100 million people. Now Laura thinks that there is a lot to learn from a history that many of us may know little about. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, lessons from the Spanish flu. Can you take us to the start of the Spanish flu outbreak? It was 1918. What was happening in the world?
Well, the world was at war. That's probably the most important thing to say.
Nobody knows what the world is going to be like when this war is over. But we do know that when this war is over, the rehabilitation of a stricken, if not paralyzed, civilization is going to be a long, drawn-out and uphill task.
And the first cases were reported officially at a military camp called Camp Funston in Kansas in America in early March of 1918. One soldier came and reported sick to the sanatorium that morning, and by lunchtime the sanatorium was overflowing with patients. So
Wow. You
can already tell that it was very transmissible amongst human beings from that first moment when it becomes visible to the world. And we know that when new pathogens spill over into the human species, they are initially quite poorly transmissible between people. They have to accumulate still the mutations that allow them to pass very easily between people. So if you see one emerge that is immediately quite contagious like that between people, it probably means that it's been trying to emerge a few times before. And maybe you had a little outbreak that fizzled out in a village somewhere and nobody spoke about it or reported it. So there were probably earlier outbreaks, and that's why the experts still say that we don't know where the so-called Spanish flu actually started. And the only thing we do know is that it didn't start in Spain.
Why was it called Spanish flu?
That's a really good question, because it shows immediately how political a pandemic can be. And I think we're seeing that again now, though not necessarily in the same way. Spain was neutral in the war and did not censor its press. So when it had the first cases in that country in the spring of 1918, it reported on them in the newspapers. And those cases included the king of Spain, Alfonso XIII, who would go on to recover.
This shows Alfonso and Queen Victoria, Toledo, Spain, attending an open-air mass. The Queen, being a first cousin of King George, makes Alfonso a member of the British royal family.
But his case basically made it really visible. Whereas other countries, including the US, Britain and France, had already had flu in their countries, but they'd kept that news out of their newspapers because they were at war and they supposedly didn't want to lower the morale of their populations. So even their own populations, unless of course people were ill themselves, didn't realise they had the flu in their countries, and it seemed to everybody that it was sort of rippling out from Madrid. So it got called the Spanish flu, and that name unfortunately stuck.
So do you think it was more that the war distracted from this flu, or the fact that the press just simply weren't able to report on it?
To begin with, it was that they were not allowed to report on it in many countries. But I think, you know, public health was in its infancy, epidemiology didn't really exist as a field, and then there was no global health agency. Many countries didn't even have ministries of health. So it was all very patchy, very confused. The doctors didn't know what they were doing. I mean, you could definitely say the world was caught on the hop by that pandemic. I mean, virus was a new concept in 1918. The first viruses had only been discovered at the end of the 19th century, and most doctors in the world thought they were dealing with a bacterial disease. So, you know, right from the start, they were on the back foot.
That's so interesting. And also dealing with it during a war that had destroyed many people's lives and caused so much upheaval. It's almost kind of unbelievable to think of that in that context, thinking that we, you know, can see the damage coronavirus is doing in our own world, which isn't experiencing the same levels of trauma that the world was in 1918.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's so interesting on many levels, but particularly on the psychological level. So, you know, in the countries that were at war, they were exhausted psychologically and in every other way. They'd just been worn down by 4 years of this grinding, bloody, murderous war.
For many, many months, civilization hung in the balance. In the despair of dark hours, it seemed as though a world dictator was inevitable.
Now here was a new disaster. And you have to remember that it was a time when, even in those countries where they had embraced germ theory, where they knew about hygiene and contagion and things, I think that their level of psychological fatigue after such a long war meant that it was just easier for them to flip back to a more kind of mystical, fatalistic understanding of the world and explanation for this disease. And so a lot of people considered it divine punishment. So there were all sorts of theories that it was noxious gases rising from the battlefields of Flanders and floating over the world, being blown all over the world, that were causing the disease. I mean, that was quite current in many countries. And then there were all the usual conspiracy theories, which we have seen again this time. You know,
there's a lot of similarities, aren't there? And actually,
totally.
In you know, you mentioned about the global response to the 1918 pandemic. Actually, it feels like there are similarities with today. We've seen a very patchy response across the world to coronavirus.
So we do have a global health agency. It's called the WHO. And its job is to coordinate countries' response in the context of a global health crisis like we're living through now, because it was recognized in 1918 that that's what was missing.
And here in Geneva, the Palace of Nations nears completion, so that those who believe the peoples of the world can live together may have a home where they can plan and work together.
But here we are again, and we have slipped back into a slightly more isolationist world, and we think that closing borders are going to keep viruses out.
I'm declaring a public health emergency of international concern over the global outbreak of novel coronavirus.
At the moment that the WHO declared a global health emergency, which is technically slightly different from a pandemic, and it did it earlier, it declared a global health emergency on the 30th of January. At that same time, in the same press release, in the same statement, said, do not close borders, it doesn't work. And immediately all sorts of countries closed their borders, starting with China's immediate neighbours, but then, you know, just spreading further afield. So they completely ignored the WHO on that point. And now they're seeing that the disease is on the inside anyway, and they've still got to deal with it. So it was either a neutral or a retrograde step, because it meant that they delayed putting in place other measures.
Was closing borders something that happened in 1918?
Yes, you saw a lot of action at the borders and a lot of stigmatizing. But anyway, yeah, you saw the Spanish were stopping trains at the border with France, making Portuguese passengers get off and disinfecting them while Spanish passengers were allowed to stay on and left in peace. There was all that kind of weird xenophobic behavior happening at borders, which of course was completely unhelpful.
You mentioned that governments kept this quiet for quite a long time. When they did start communicating to the public about this flu, what did they say?
The answer depends very much on where you were in the world. Maybe I can take the example of New York, which was probably one of the most advanced cities in the world at the time in terms of public health, mainly because the authorities there had declared a war on tuberculosis 20 years earlier, fining people for spitting and taking all sorts of other measures to try and rein in the spread of that terrible disease. So people in New York were kind of used to the authorities intervening in their lives, if you like, for the collective good in terms of health. And they were also pretty much on a sort of war footing. And so the public health campaign became tangled up in people's minds with the war effort. So it was your patriotic duty to wear a mask and to do all the other things that were being recommended, avoid mass gatherings and so on. And they also had a pretty enlightened health commissioner in charge, a man called Royal Copeland.
Dr. Copeland is one of the world's most famous physicians, and he will talk to you daily over this station on matters of general health.
Who, interestingly, was a homeopath and an eye surgeon, which would strike us as an odd combination. But actually, he put in place a few measures which probably are the main reason that the overall flu-related mortality in New York was very low compared to the rest of the world, but also to other American cities.
What did he do?
He did three main things. He staggered rush hour, you know, staggered the closing and opening times of shops and factories so that people weren't meeting in trams and public places all at the same time. He set up an emergency clearinghouse system across the city to do a kind of triage of the sick, you know, kind of filter them before the hospitals so that the hospitals weren't overwhelmed, and also to try to some extent to keep the infected apart from people with other medical problems, which is again what we're trying to do today. And the third thing he did, it's a little harder to say whether it had a good impact, and it was very controversial at the time. He kept the schools in New York open. And that was the fruit of a heated debate, and a lot of criticism came down on his head for it. But he was probably thinking of the immigrant populations in New York at that time. New York was expanding very rapidly at that time. The biggest and fastest growing group at that time was the Italians, followed probably closely by the Eastern European Jews. And these were people who were very poor, lived in crowded tenements. And he realized that sending the children back to a tenement block where people were sleeping 10 to a room was not going to probably improve the situation. And it'd be probably better to keep them in school where they might get fed properly. And he could also then use the children as messengers to take public health messages back to their parents who often didn't speak English. So for all those reasons, he decided to keep the schools in New York open. By the way, in Massachusetts and New Jersey, the neighboring states, they decided immediately to close them. But I think it illustrates the right decision for each place might not be the same as the right decision for another place. You have to take into account your local context, your local socioeconomic spread, cultural factors, religious factors, you know, how densely people are living and where. All sorts of things might shape what is the right decision in each place. And that was his job, to take those into account for New York.
Yeah, and he sounds like he came up with some very innovative solutions to quite specific problems in the city. I think it's really interesting that actually the tools that governments had in 1918 sound incredibly similar to the tools that governments have now in 2020.
Yeah, sure. And people also resisted those measures to some extent. It was a time when people were much more respectful of authority and there was a war on. So I think for lots of reasons, people were much more willing to listen to those authority figures and do what they were told. But you still saw examples where they didn't in America, again in New York, when Charlie Chaplin's film Shoulder Arms premiered in the autumn of 1918 at the peak of the pandemic. Royal Copeland, the health commissioner, hadn't actually closed places of entertainment, but he did restrict access to them. And you saw the manager of the Strand Theatre, which was a big cinema on Times Square, Harold Edel, congratulating people for their massive turnout to see Shoulder Arms in his cinema. And he wrote those words in a newspaper or in a newsletter of some kind, which was published a few weeks later, by which time, unfortunately, Harold Edel was dead. And you see similar things here. I mean, in Italy, a prominent politician had a party in Milan while the pandemic was in the offing. It was on the theme of Milan won't stop, carry on going out, carry on going to the theatres, carry on with your normal life. And he too, just a few days later, came down with coronavirus.
Allora, è arrivato anche io il coronavirus. Ovviamente mi attengo e sarò seguito secondo tutti I protocolli.
So you see the same kind of pushback against government strategy.
After this, Laura reveals some of the unusual remedies and cures people use to treat Spanish flu. Laura, coronavirus has been a very complex and fast-moving story for the media to follow. How did journalists in 1918 cover the Spanish flu?
There was a lot of rumour, a lot of mixed messages. Some newspapers, because newspapers were the main means of conveying news at that time, some of them were more responsible than others. So there were those that passed on the conspiracy theories For example, there was one rumour that German U-boats landing on the east coast of America were spreading flu like some kind of bioweapon. That was expressed by someone in authority in the States and picked up by some of the newspapers. So they didn't do a terribly good job of stopping rumours, but, you know, hey, we're not doing any better today. Also, their public health messages were quite confused as well.
Oh, why?
Well, you know, sometimes they said masks help, sometimes they didn't, sometimes... the confusion was not just theirs, the confusion was the doctors and the scientists as well. So, you know, there was all this confusion going on, and it was going into the newspapers as well, and rather like today, people didn't know where they were coming or going.
Yeah, I mean, a very confusing time. And with that, were people also treating themselves for the flu in ways they shouldn't have?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we are much better equipped in that sense. We don't have a vaccine, as I mentioned, but we do have various medicines that can help. We have some antivirals and hopefully others coming online, which are more tailored to this particular virus soon. We have antibiotics, which, although flu is caused by a virus, might help with some bacterial complications that can cause pneumonia in some patients. And we have ventilators, we have very competent doctors and nurses. They lacked most of these things in 1918. In fact, really the only thing they had that might have had any effect in terms of medicines was the so-called wonder drug, aspirin. And even that, they usually overprescribed to a huge extent, so causing worse side effects than the symptoms of the disease itself in many cases. And so, not unreasonably, lots of people turned to folk cures, ancient things that had been passed down through their families, superstitious ideas about what would ward off the plague. It's the same thing.
Yeah, and I think we've all probably been sent messages from friends giving various remedies that definitely don't work. I think I was told, don't drink cold water. You should never drink cold water.
One. Yeah. But it's had some pretty, yeah, I mean, should you drink alcohol? Shouldn't you? Does it help? Doesn't it? We put alcohol on our hands. Would it be good on the inside of us as well? People, you know, a certain amount of wishful thinking. But, you know, your broader point was about fake news. And fake news is not new. But with the internet, just the volume of it and the speed of it means I think it could almost be a bigger problem now than it was in 1918.
You mentioned there about some of the ways people tried to deal with it. How did this flu eventually go away?
So every pandemic is more or less shaped like a bell curve and basically tails off as it runs out of susceptible hosts because either they recover or they die. And so every epidemic or pandemic will go away in its own eventually. And we can make a difference if we limit its spread in all the ways that I described earlier. But I think when you look at 1918, you're essentially looking at a pandemic that ran its natural course because we were so helpless against it.
Laura, I probably should admit that before I'd read your piece, I'd spent very little time thinking about the Spanish flu pandemic. But why could understanding more about it help prevent an event like the one we're living through now from happening again?
Because I think it drives home the point in no uncertain terms that pandemics are things that happen to us and that we probably can't stop them happening again, although we can maybe limit the number or make them less impactful. Therefore, there will be other pandemics and that we need to do everything we can to prepare for them because once the bug is out, it's very difficult, as we've seen again this time, to get it back in. And that means doing all the things that the WHO has been telling us to do for a very long time and to start doing them outside of pandemics, not wait till the pandemic hits, which are things like invest in health infrastructure in the poorest countries because we're only as safe as our least safe place. We do learn lessons from each new epidemic or pandemic. We make advances, we make progress, but not as fast as we could do because of human nature, which we seem to swing from panic to complacency. Everybody is suddenly talking about the pandemic that I wrote about because everybody had forgotten about it. Will we still be talking about the Spanish flu when the coronavirus pandemic has passed? I don't know. We'll see. But it would be good if we would realise that we are vulnerable and we are vulnerable as a whole species together. We're all in it. And therefore, we need to pull together, rather like with climate change, to reduce the threat that pandemics pose to us.
A lot of your work comes from diaries that were written at the time. Mm. Do you think we should all be keeping one now?
Yeah, I think so, because future historians will be very grateful for them. And also because we've got to find something to do while we're self-confined.
Definitely that, yeah.
And also because the view from everybody's balcony is different.
That's very true. Laura, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure.
Laura Spinney is the author of Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. It's available to buy now. I'm sure you're all finding innovative ways to stay in touch with friends and family at the moment. But are any of you thinking about dating while on lockdown? We're looking for people who would like to go on a blind virtual date and be willing to record it for an episode of Today in Focus. If you'd like to take part, then send us your details using the form at theguardian.com/COVID-19 questions. That's theguardian.com/COVID-19 questions. And yes, we will provide both of you with a delicious takeaway for the evening. Today's episode was produced by Mithali Rao and sound design was by Ian Chambers. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back with you tomorrow.